Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we'll get a preview of Tuesday's French-U.S. summit in Washington. Our correspondent in Belgium will share what she's found there concerning refugees. Our cyber guru tells us about a possible doomsday scenario.
These devices are decades old. They were designed before security was even a thought, and they are perhaps the biggest vulnerability facing the United States right now.
And there's a new special award for the First Lady of Country Music. It's right here on The Voice of America. Belgium, headquarters of European Union and NATO institutions, remains on its highest state of alert today, with schools and the Brussels metro system closed, amid fears of a repeat of the terrorist attacks that killed 130 people and wounded hundreds of others in Paris, November 13th. Monash University European Union analyst Ben Wellings in Australia says the security lockdown in Belgium is closely tied to the Paris attacks.
The attackers in Paris did come from Belgium, and Belgian society has some of the same issues, if you like, around integration or accommodation or facilitation of minorities, particularly Muslim minorities, as France does. Not exactly the same, but not dissimilar. So in some ways it is linked to deeper themes within Belgian and Western European society. So what it seems, though, of course, is that one of the attackers has fled back to Belgium, and this is what's given the very specific, credible claim to the security crisis that we're now seeing.
We asked how likely it is that an international coalition against ISIS can be forged.
Of course, you know, initially everyone will support this initiative. The question is to what extent and how much will that involve military cooperation, particularly on the ground. First thing to do is that David Cameron is very keen to get involved in Syria, but back in 2013 this was blocked by the Labour Party, and that means that Britain's only been involved in Iraq. It may be blocked by the Labour Party again. Barack Obama will be very receptive, but opinion in America is not favourable towards a sort of a boots-on-the-ground escalation, so that will be a difficulty there. Germany, typically reluctant to get involved beyond its own borders, even if it did have forces under NATO command in Afghanistan and Kosovo. But again, a reluctance there. The interesting thing is Russia. To what extent will France pull Russia into this orbit?
The White House is preparing for tomorrow's visit by the French President, François Hollande. And our correspondent from the White House, Alru Pandey, has joined me here in our studios to give us a little preview. What do you expect to happen tomorrow, Alru? And first of all, let me welcome you.
Thank you so much, Susan. Well, the White House has come out and said that this really will be an opportunity for President Obama to underscore the friendship and solidarity with France and President Hollande. Obviously, just days after this terrorist attack in Paris, President Obama has called France the United States' oldest ally. And both the leaders will be looking to consult and coordinate, especially on this investigation into the attack. And also further cooperation in this counter-ISIL coalition that is fighting the Islamic State militant group in Iraq and Syria. So we will be seeing both a symbolic visit with Hollande speaking with Obama tomorrow, and both are expected to also address reporters as well. But this also, I think President Hollande will be coming here after meeting with Prime Minister Cameron in Britain. So he will be looking for some more deliverables, I believe, in this push against the Islamic State. So it'll be symbolic, but also I think France and President Hollande will be looking for something more substantial as well.
Maybe you could just to clarify for us a bit, what do you mean by deliverables?
Well, we've sought that. Obviously, Prime Minister Cameron in Britain went to Paris and met with Hollande and basically said he'd be taking the case to Parliament, to the British Parliament, to maybe start launching airstrikes in Syria against the Islamic State. Cameron also announced that France would be able to use one of their launch sites in Cyprus to launch airstrikes. So I think what Hollande wants to see, and what he said, is more of a joining forces. And he mentioned Russia in that, and Russia is a big factor here. After he meets with Obama, Hollande will be traveling and meeting with Putin to see what more can be done in all these big countries, whether it be the United States, Britain, and France, and Russia can come together in really solidifying a strategy there. Now, we heard President Obama this week say there will not be a major change in his strategy against the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, and we're not sure how that was received by Hollande. Obama has said that they will talk about streamlining the intel sharing process, but in terms of a more resolute strategy in going after the Islamic State, I think Hollande will be probably pressing Obama on what more the United States can do, maybe taking a more aggressive stance, but also involving Russia in this coalition and Russia playing more of a role in fighting the Islamic State, which is what President Putin has said he wants to do.
Well, thank you very much, Haru.
Thank you.
The debate in the United States about whether to bring in more Syrian refugees has become heated. Some Americans say those refugees should be blocked until security checks are tightened, while other Americans want to bring in more refugees and criticize calls to block them as anti-Muslim. That anti-Muslim label is a big topic on Twitter today, and Michael Lippin is here to tell us more. Michael.
Hi, Susan. That's right. One of the big trending topics on Twitter right now in the United States is the phrase, anti-Muslim is anti-American. The Topsy Analytics website shows that it's been tweeted more than 5,000 times in the past day, with almost 2,000 mentions in the last hour. What appears to have started this trend is a liberal commentary in the New York Times newspaper. The piece by columnist Charles M. Blow is titled, "Anti-Muslim is Anti-American," and he starts by saying, "There seems to be no bottom to the cesspool of Islamophobic rhetoric coming from U.S. Republican presidential candidates. The tone of anti-Muslim musings post-Paris attacks has become so poisonous that it cannot portend anything positive." Well, many of those Republican candidates have supported calls to suspend the entry of Syrian refugees to prevent terrorists from sneaking in. One of those candidates, as Blow points out, also has advocated closing certain mosques in the U.S., and we're talking about frontrunner Donald Trump. But the use of the term anti-Muslim is anti-American also has led to a backlash on social media from some conservatives. Here are a few tweets that I've seen. One from a user at Zamp Andrews says, "Anti-Muslim is anti-American is a divisive false premise. Saying radical Islam does not make you a racist." And here's another from a user by the handle of As Red As My Hair. She says, "Anti-Muslim is anti-American, yet liberals can be anti-everything they don't like. Funny that it's anti-American when it suits them. Hypocrites." Susan, back to you.
Okay, well, thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Well, you've decided to cook up that piece of meat you bought a few days ago, but you wonder if it's spoiled. Many of us use the old sniff test. If the meat smells kind of funny, we become concerned. But commercial food suppliers who supply tons of meat to consumers need more than that sniff test to determine if the meat they're about to ship is good. Scientists writing in the American Chemical Society Journal say that they've come up with a new portable and simple system to determine whether meat is safe to eat. Using extremely fluorescent and hollow nanotubes, this newly developed system detects the compounds that are emitted as meat decomposes. The compounds cause the bright fluorescent nanotubes to dim. The researchers exposed their device to meat that sat in a refrigerator for a couple of days and found that more than a 10% decrease in the tube's glow meant that the meat is spoiled. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Right now, our correspondent, Heather Murdoch, is in Brussels, Belgium, and she is investigating the refugee situation. And welcome, first of all, to the show.
Thank you.
So, Heather, what is the situation there?
Here in Brussels, there are many refugees from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, from all over the world, really. But we also have a situation where there is a massive security alert. So the security is very high here. And one of the situations that we're facing is that some people believe that this security will actually make local people afraid of the refugees. This is something I'm hearing from refugees themselves, their fears.
There are also fears here in the United States about refugees from Syria, and there's worries about discrimination against Muslims. Do you have that feeling there as well?
Yes, there's both. Both of those things are going on. People are afraid that they're going forward, there will be discrimination against Muslims. There hasn't been a whole lot of reports of discrimination, but there have been some. Like, for instance, one man was saying today that after the Paris attacks, the local police in his area were going around finding out where all the Arab people lived. He also made a point that the fear is actually not exactly generated directly towards refugees, but towards Arab people in general, refugees and more specifically. Other thing he said is that at some point he was sitting on a bus talking with his friend in Arabic, and the people moved, and he thought it was because of the language they were speaking.
Are the refugees beyond this scrupulous eye on them? Are they being treated fairly? Do they have food and shelter, and are they getting medical care?
Well, you know, in Europe, there's a lot of people, refugees right now. There are facilities. The facilities are not terrible. They're not like what you would see in a refugee camp in the Middle East or Africa, for sure. People are inside. There is food. I mean, there's a lot of degrees of what's okay. Like, for instance, I talked to some people in Germany the other day, and they said they couldn't possibly eat the food at the camp. It was too small and just not good, so they had to get their own food. They were checked out by doctors, but they said the doctors really didn't really check them out. They just kind of looked them over and said, "Are you sick?" And they said, "No." And they said, "Okay, you're good, go." So, you know, there's definitely across the continent an effort, an organized effort to make these things available for the people. But there's so many people. And there's also so many resources. And there's also, you know, in a big system like this that's just developing, there's also bound to be abuses. Like I've heard people say, well, we think that there's corruption in some areas in the food industry, like food companies might be getting a lot of money and not using enough of it to actually provide nutritious food. This is allegations that nothing has been proven, particularly on this point, but there's a lot of disorganization because it's happening so fast.
Well, thank you very much, Heather, for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on International Edition, brace yourself for some scary cyber news. And country music's Loretta Lynn is once again honored. Security in Washington and across the United States is tightening following new videos reportedly released by Islamic State, specifically threatening an attack on New York City and Washington. But while security officials work to harden potential targets against any terrorist threats, a growing number of cybersecurity analysts are warning some of the most critical U.S. assets are all but unprotected, namely the nation's millions of digital operational networks that control everything from water treatment to manufacturing to the electric grid. International Edition's Doug Bernard, our cyber specialist, is here with me. Doug, you're scaring me again.
Well, perhaps with good cause. And it's not me, ideally, who's scaring you. But there are a lot of cybersecurity analysts out there who indeed are saying some very scary things. What they're talking about specifically are not the sort of security things that we've spoken about often. Our computers being, you know, infected, data being stolen from networks, that sort of thing. This is something very different. It's called OT, operational technology. And it involves the millions upon millions of small devices that control many of our industrial processes. So they're not they're not used for emailing or for other kinds of things. They're monitoring pressure. They're monitoring temperature, that sort of thing, and making adjustments so that everything works properly. Now, in order for all of these devices to do their job, they need to talk to each other. But many analysts, and I've actually spoken with a number of analysts looking for a counter view, and I couldn't find it, to a last one. They all said these devices are decades old. They were designed before security was even a thought, and they are perhaps the biggest vulnerability facing the United States right now.
When it snows in Washington, the city comes to a standstill. Right. But we still stay home and get on the computers and the phones and have lights, right, and have heat and everything.
Right.
Doesn't this mean that it's a possibility that we could get even more frozen out?
Oh, absolutely. And that's actually a great term. Several high-ranking U.S. officials, in fact, have used that exact scenario. So let's take the power grid, for example. Hacking groups were able to gain access to, let's say several devices, creating actual physical destruction at power generating facilities. So for a period of time, there's no power generated. Those generators contribute to the national electric grid. If you have several of them drop out at once, you could have major portions, say the entire eastern seaboard, power simply fail, not fail for hours or days, but people are saying literally for weeks or months until the equipment is being able to be repaired. That would lead to complete, I think, chaos nationally. Now, that's a worst-case doomsday scenario, but the analysts that I've spoken with all say we need to be thinking about this because, well, one, they say it's not a matter of if, it's simply a matter of when and how bad.
You're going to say there is no cure for this at this time. We got to think of it.
Well, there are cures, but what it takes is serious concerted effort by governments and by industry to correct these systems. That is a multi-billion-dollar, multi-year process.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Doug.
You bet.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Loretta Lynn is known as the First Lady of Country Music. She's receiving a new award in honor of her many decades of country hits. International Edition Sarah Williams speaks with Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about this latest tribute.
The 2015 Billboard Women in Music Awards takes place December 11th in New York City. It's a ceremony that's continuing to develop and grow. This year, they've added a new award, the first ever Billboard Women in Music Legend Award. Country icon Loretta Lynn will be its first recipient. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to talk about it. Nikki, this is a huge honor. Tell us about Loretta Lynn's legacy.
Okay, Loretta is awesome. She's a trailblazer. Her work is marked with fearlessness and honesty. She became a part of the country music scene in the 1960s. Now, as a songwriter, she wrote about whatever she wanted, as long as it spoke to other women, and many of her songs were autobiographical. So her songs focused a lot on blue-collar women's issues. She talked about cheating men and persistent mistresses, both of which she dealt with in her marriage. She wrote about many things that were considered scandalous, too. She sang about birth control in her song The Pill, double standards for men and women, being widowed after the draft during the Vietnam War in her song, for example, Dear Uncle Sam, she talked about, or sang about the loss of teenage virginity. Consequently, many country radio stations actually banned her music. But she continued to persevere, and she became one of the major legends who continued to lay the groundwork for many of the country artists that you see today, female and otherwise. In 1976, she released her autobiography, Coal Miner's Daughter. It became the number one bestseller, making her the first country music artist to make the New York Times bestseller list. This opened the door for tons of other country artists to write books. And then in 1980, her autobiography, Coal Miner's Daughter, became an Oscar-winning film. And in the early 1980s, she became the first American female recording artist to chart over 50 top 10 hits. She has been inducted. I mean, it's extensive. She has been inducted into more music halls of fame than any other female recording artist. In 2010, she received the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award for her 50 years in country music. President Barack Obama honored her with a Presidential Medal of Freedom. She was also a recipient of the Kennedy Center Honor in 2003, and she is also the first female country artist to receive a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 1977. So the awards, the honors, the hit songs are extensive. And her partnership, I would be remiss if I didn't include this, her partnership with Conway Twitty was quite prosperous and filled with tons of accomplishments as well. They are the most successful and most awarded male-female duet team in country music history.
Now, she's about to release a new CD as well.
Yeah, I think this is perfect timing. So this will be her first solo album in more than 10 years. It's called Full Circle. It's set to drop March 4th. It'll be a little bit of the old and a little bit of the new. According to a press release, the project takes listeners on a journey through Loretta's musical story, from the Appalachian folk songs and gospel music she learned as a child to new interpretations of her classic hits and country standards to songs newly written for the project. So I know it includes a duet with Willie Nelson and a song with Elvis Costello. Also, on the same day that Full Circle is released, a new documentary about her life and career is going to air on PBS. It's called American Masters, Loretta Lynn, Still a Mountain Girl. So that will happen March 4th as well. And Full Circle is now available on pre-order, too.
Well, you can hear more about country music with Nikki Strong on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music and on Twitter at VOA underscore music. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Well, I was born to call.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA underline IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll on down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, at the very beginning of a new millennium, the world faces what Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken called a threat that does not stop at borders and does not distinguish among its victims. In every corner of the globe, in every country represented here today in ways big and small, violent extremists have left their mark, murdering, terrorizing, and preaching an ideology of nihilism and fear that seeks to defy humanity. These remarks came at a high-level event on preventing violent extremism through education, organized by the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, and the permanent mission of the United States during the 38th General Conference at UNESCO headquarters. Deputy Secretary Blinken added, "Our weapon of choice in this fight is a weapon surpassing any that extremists possess, one that delivers a blow that no agent of hate or intolerance can withstand. It is the bright light of education." In the words of UNESCO Director General Irina Bokova, "Violent extremists offer destruction and hatred. We must respond with culture and knowledge. Violent extremists promote fear and division. We must respond with skills for critical thinking, with opportunities for civic engagement, with competences for dialogue across cultures." UNESCO has a program available to ministries that request it called Global Citizenship Education. It helps create a learning environment that promotes a free exchange of ideas. The hope is to raise a generation of responsible global citizens by instilling in students a respect for human rights, social justice, diversity, gender equality, and environmental sustainability. Building on this program, the United States will take the next step and help develop a digital education resource to prevent and undermine the allure of violent extremism. By arming young minds with a world perspective rooted in respect, social justice, diversity, and critical thinking, we can counter radicalization as it arises and even prevent its growth in the first place, said Deputy Secretary Blinken. By investing in their future, we secure ours. The alternative is too tragic to even contemplate. Without a quality education, these children are in danger of being exploited, forced to work, pressured into early marriage, conscripted as child soldiers, or become prey to the siren song of violent extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.